All right, welcome back to another episode of Friends from Work, a podcast about all things in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and it's a podcast that's hosted by myself, Kyle Sconewell, and my longtime friend from work, Robbie Earle. Because of the rhythm of this stuff, we saw Spider-Man Brand New Day a week or so before the public did, recorded that episode, and then last week being a little bit different, talking to Dan Gavazdin, we're just kind of realizing sitting here on Friday, August 14, that you and I have not yet really kind of reflected on the success of Spider-Man Brand New Day. That's the weird time gap where we haven't gotten a chance to do that outside of Discord and a few other social media places.
Right.
Really quick, some housekeeping things since we're just now kind of getting back to the rhythm of these weekly episodes. Yeah, our Spider-Man Brand New Day initial reactions episode is out and available now. If you are just turning off the movie, go listen to that. It was a really fun episode to do. Spotify actually featured it on their front page. And so we've been getting a lot of traction over there. So that's been really fun. This week, we have a really fun interview coming up. For the back half of this episode with our friend Chip Zdarsky. I'm going to let Robbie tell you more about that in a minute. Over on Friends from Work Plus, I relaunched Friends from Football. So if you're into football stuff, it was fun to chat with some people who are football fans and Marvel fans like me. Next week, a Kyle Listened episode on Friends from Work Plus, where I did go back and listen to all of the audio series from Stitcher and Marvel, the Marvels, kind of a spinoff of the story that we read on Friends from Work Plus from Alex Ross, Marvels, and Kurt Busiek. Busiek.
Yeah.
Next week will be our full official reflection on Spider-Man Brand New Day from a content standpoint. There's actually a few things that we didn't really get really into the weeds on in our 90-minute initial reactions, and hopefully go see it a second time. I still haven't seen it a second time, you know, kids, all that. But that will be next week, so stay tuned if you want even more of that content. And lastly, I'll say, this weekend, like in a few hours, Disney has their big D23 conference.
Which
is a lot of announcements for all of Disney stuff, all of their properties, but Marvel Studios is rumored to have a big chunk. And there are some theories about X-Men castings and things like that being official. Then maybe an update on the television side of things, since that's really drastically changing. We don't even know if there's going to be any more shows, period, Robbie, after season 3 of Daredevil Born Again. They may go away altogether, or do they have some more announcements, et cetera? So anyways, there's my 5-minute intro to say, stay tuned for next week, and let's get into a few things here about Spider-Man Brand New Day and the reception of it, Robbie, before the Chip interview.
I've been thinking a lot about why this has been such a big moment, and if you're tuning in and you don't follow all this stuff, you may not know how much money this movie is making.
That's right.
But it's doing things that I think a lot of folks thought we would not see this side of COVID. And we're now having conversations about whether even Doomsday will be able to top what Brand New Day is likely going to wind up doing at the box office. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I think not. I think it's going to be the third highest grossing movie ever behind Avatar and Avengers Endgame, and then this movie. As we sit here today recording this, it passed Avengers Infinity War, and it's coming up on the $2 billion mark. So just to put that in perspective, how big was The Odyssey, right? Like, what a moment that was, and what a big movie. That just crossed the $1 billion mark. So right. In 2 weeks less time, we're double that. Double that already.
Yeah. Yeah, which is also crazy because I think I was reading that The Odyssey now Nolan's highest grossing film?
Yep, passing The Dark Knight Rises and I think the second highest rated R movie ever, only behind Deadpool and Wolverine, Marvel, but there's still a chance it could catch that.
So it's wild to me because even when you have Nolan, who, you know, you look at something like The Dark Knight Rises and you have both at that point, Nolan was already kind of an established entity in his own right, you know, between The Prestige and certainly Inception. And you also had the Batman, you have Batman as a character, that is a big draw. And then you have his Batman story, specifically following up on The Dark Knight, which was a huge draw. And it is telling that, one, the Odyssey that's coming out now in the era after everybody is saying, you know, maybe movie theaters are going away, can beat those films from over a decade ago. But then, yeah, to talk about Brand New Day coming out ahead of that. And I think it's an interesting moment to reflect on this piece of it, because a lot of the narrative up to this point, when we've looked at the box office this year, has been about how the franchises that you maybe would have expected to be sure things have floundered at the box office. And
Star Wars?
Right. Star Wars, Supergirl, the He-Man movie, depending on how much faith ever had in something like that. But like the IP
those
things.
Two mainly. Yeah.
And then you look at something like Obsession or Backrooms and these movies that are kind of out of nowhere, have no franchise to hook into, have no name to attach to them. Yep. And they suddenly become these massive moments. And so I think heading into Brand New Day, you know, the Odyssey was always going to be kind of different because Nolan gets the benefit of both camps in a way, because everyone has so much respect for him as a filmmaker that I don't think people view what he's doing as like it's mainstream, but it's not it's also kind of arty in people's minds. I think that Brand New Day to me was the first movie that seems to buck what was until now a trend of those big IP movies no longer interesting people. And Spider-Man is a character that, like, on the one hand, you can say, oh, well, it's Spider-Man. Everybody loves Spider-Man. But that can cut both ways, too. You know, it's like, I think that you could say, it's Spider-Man. How many more Spider-Man movies do we need? We've seen every story they can tell. We've seen it animated. We've seen it in live action. We saw No Way Home give us all three Spider-Man, and that was so satisfying. What right. can they do that gets people genuinely excited, even if the movie is great?
Right.
And obviously people are very excited, and we're seeing people go in droves. And I don't think, I guess my point as an opener is, I don't think that you get there just by slapping the name Spider-Man on something.
No, you're right. It's been an absolutely insane moment. You're right about the trend that was forming, and then the trend got totally bucked because Toy Story 5 got people out in droves, which is an IP.
That's also true, yeah.
And
yeah,
then
that's right.
The Odyssey comes out, and then Spider-Man comes out. And again, just to reiterate, it's not just going well. It's becoming the largest movie of all time. Of all time in this era.
Yeah.
So why is the question, if that's what we're trying to get to. Why
and,
is
and
that
it's a
the
superhero
case?
Movie, which I think is important, even as distinguished from like Mando or like Toy Story 5 on the plus side. Like I think it's because there's been this, not only the anti-IP narrative, but as we've talked about for years now, the superhero fatigue thing.
We could toss out so many different examples or ideas or reasons. Let's just toss some of them out. Before I toss them out, I want to say it just gets me really excited, not only for Marvel and superhero movies. It gets me really excited for theaters just because I just don't think I ever saw a year like this coming. I really didn't. I posted this on social media. I think that's an absolute win. And I think it's a win. This is going to sound too intense. It's a win for culture because it's a win for people deciding to like put their phones down, spend time with other people, and go do something else, like investing into a story. I was just editing a Kyle Listened episode from Neil that he put this so well. It's like the power of story is still there. You know, like no matter what the medium is, it can move us to feel things, to change how we see things in our life. We can even learn a lesson from a movie that helps us avoid a painful situation because we saw what happened to somebody else who went down this path or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think getting back to theaters is a huge win for culture in that way. And I was nervous. There was times, you know, this in 21 where I thought we may never have theaters, period. Like theaters just may close.
Right.
the way that was trending. And it feels like now there's a massive cultural pushback the other way, like streaming platforms struggling and being like, I don't know if we should do this. And all of a sudden theaters are kind of king.
Yeah.
And shows are getting canceled everywhere. It's kind of wild. And streaming platforms trying to wrestle with, do we go back to like cable? Because it's not always working for all these different shows. I know there are a few that do work, obviously.
Yeah,
but there's a lot of the back catalog that isn't.
Okay, but even, the last couple of years, I feel like the story has been, even as other streaming services are struggling, Netflix has been the constant, and now even Netflix is having issues.
I just saw a graphic that there's been $8 billion movies since Netflix's CEO famously said the theater experience is dead. Like, people want to watch at home. And since he said that, there's been over a billion dollar movies. $1 billion. Spider-Man's making $2 billion with a B dollars. Think about how, I mean, that's,
yeah,
it's unfathomable money. And I think I'm going to go on a little bit of a tangent here. And hold on. Before I go on the tangent, let's say, one, I think the first thing is they're good movies.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, The Odyssey and Spider-Man are good movies. And I think I'm going to toss that out as, you know, cinema scores of A. Audience is being pulled going, that was a really good time at the theaters. So not getting into all the nitty gritty, I think overall, that's the first thing. You know, Spider-Man, 92% critic, 98% audience. So no matter what, you do have to make a good movie. The second thing I toss out to you is, and Dan hinted at this, that they advertise it to this. I do think it is this. He didn't think it was this to this certain degree. But there has been an actual push, an anti-AI push is what I'll put it. Christopher Nolan made a movie where we went on location, we got a ton of actors, we got them all invested, they had long work hours, they had to live inside a freaking horse, cold and wet. Like, it was very like hands-on human. And then Spider-Man, I think, again, pushing back on Dan, same kind of thing. It's like Destin's highlighting every creator, you know, for a month up to it on Instagram, this part of the process. We went to cities and filmed these shots. We had him falling off buildings. We had him tied to ropes, jumping off things. The suit is actually a cloth suit that he can wear. And he does wear amongst fans and kids. And
I think even Dan, by the way, would agree that Spider-Man marketed itself, that it highlighted that stuff in the marketing.
And you know, I think the end result also feels that way. That's where I disagree with him, like specifically what he said.
Yeah.
That's got to be point number two, right? It's got to be.
For sure. And I think that is, to my mind, that's the crux of it. And I actually think that it is the same point, or I don't know. It feels like the same conversation that you were just kind of hinting at with the streaming versus theater thing, in that I think for a while there was this idea that why go to the theater? Why pay all that money to go see one movie when it's like one night to go see a movie with even just two people is going to be more than a month subscription to get, you know, countless movies on whatever streaming platform. And especially in the pandemic era, and there are obviously justifiable reasons there. And it's not like a moral thing one way or the other, whether you go to the theater or not. But I think that what we are seeing is people don't want more content. Like, people are already exhausted by content after being inundated by it for so many years, because it's like you get it on the social media front, you get it on the streaming front, and it's just like algorithms are pumping stuff at you and it feels like you have no real agency in that. It's hard to figure out what is worth watching and what isn't worth watching. And so then you have to go on your phone and look to see what people are saying about it. And it's this whole thing that I think it can leave you with a kind of sour stomach. Like, there's just not a lot of fun in that. Whereas, like, when there is something that is happening and it's a moment at the theater where you have to make a point to plan to go see it.
To get there.
And if you have kids, to get someone to watch the kids or to see if you can bring the kids or whatever. And then especially with The Odyssey, where Nolan sort of doubles down on that. And he's like, not only do you need to figure out a time to go see this 3-hour movie, you need to go see it in a very specific theater setting, if at all possible. And instead of people being like, please, like, don't, you know, I'm not going to go do that. People are like, absolutely, I will do that.
They're traveling to it instead.
Because there's something exciting about it being worth it. Like, it's like, okay, this is, like, I will put in the work if there is something on the other side. And there's also that level of, I think, putting in that work, again, not that it's like some crazy strenuous thing to go to the theater, but deciding to do something like that and making the plan and following through, I actually think makes you more likely to enjoy the movie anyway, because you've kind of decided to be intentional with your time and all the stuff that is always talked about with whether you're on your phone, the distractions and all of that.
Right. Even just thinking about watching it at home and the washing machine's going and your daughter's waking up occasionally and saying she needs something and you're looking at your phone. And so you have to pause the movie and then you get done and go, that wasn't very engaging. And it's like, well, you know, did you really give it a chance to steal your attention over all these other things? What I think is interesting though, Rob, too, is all those first two points I think are totally valid. You know, Thunderbolts and Fantastic Four, not quality as like commentary here, because I think they're fantastic movies. But they both kind of marketed themselves, if you remember, as that. You know, Thunderbolts was Marvel does an A24 film and we're hiring like independent directors and we're going to shoot everything practically. And then Fantastic Four was, we're going to hire the guy who crushed WandaVision. He's obsessed with comics. He's going through every panel possible to capture the feel of Fantastic Four. And they like brought comics creators to the set to tour.
They build out all the stuff.
That was all part of the marketing. We're going to actually build Herbie. He's going to go on stage and talk.
Yeah.
And, you know, everything possible you could do on the indie front. And both of those made under $1 billion. I think one was like 500 million, one was like 800 million or 900 million. So still okay movies, but like not even remotely close to the 2.5 billion that Spider-Man's going to have. So what's the next point then? Is that the power of just Spider-Man? Has culture changed so much in 1 year? Is it partially the Marvel Studios drought? Like the last movie was over a year ago?
Is it the Spider-Man
drought? You know?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's both or all three. I mean, I think
there's a bump just because it's Spider-Man, period.
Right, right. And, I do think that when you're talking about superhero names, I think Spider-Man and Batman live in a category of their own.
I agree.
Because even over Superman,
right. Just because it hasn't been done as successfully ever, right?
Yeah, like I there's just something that people are always down to see that character reinvented and retold. Now, again,
I think Batman and Superman, Batman and Spider-Man, they're the relatable hero, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and there's just a cool factor there, I think, that you don't always get with other heroes. And I think that certainly helps with Spider-Man. Like everybody, you know, it's like kids... Whether you have the Spidey and His Amazing Friends show that's kind of raising kids up to love Spider-Man, whether you have you're talking about the Spider-Man games that are raising kids and teens to love Spider-Man.
And 37-year-olds.
And you've got the Spider-Verse movies that are priming people to love that universe, but I don't think necessarily like... those whet your appetite for more live action stuff. They don't take the place of it. So I think there's a lot that is pushing people in the direction here. But I do think that this is where I'm trying to figure out exactly where Spider-Man lives in the superhero fatigue narrative. Because yes, I think Spider-Man is different. Both because of the popularity of the character, but also because the character sort of pre-exists the MCU as we know it, even though the character is in the MCU now.
Yeah, for sure.
And so whenever I look at, you know, like Thunderbolts, I think the problem, if you view it that way, with Thunderbolts is that it is a straight-up Marvel Cinematic Universe movie. So if you are not invested in the MCU,
yep,
why go see Thunderbolts?
And it's all newer-ish characters, too.
Right.
So it's not even pulling on the nostalgia of you were invested in 2015, and here's this character, other than Bucky.
Other than Bucky, yeah, which a lot of people would view as a fairly minor character in the grand scheme of the Infinity Saga.
That's right.
And then Fantastic Four, I think, like, to me, that I would have thought would pull more people in by recognition alone. But
and
again,
it did okay.
Yeah, yeah. It's still something where I think...
it was about Superman levels, I think.
Right. And that kind of makes sense to me. But I guess, like... I think it's Spider-Man can stand on his own as Spider-Man, but also I think that people felt like there's almost some weird counter programming in there. And I guess what I'm trying to get at is it seems like certain people that may even be, you know, quote unquote over the MCU are like really amped on Spider-Man and almost view it as like a, like,
sure. There's like a few people online that are like Sony could do this and Disney could never do this, even though it's still Marvel Studios either way.
Yeah,
Sony and Disney are just distributing it. They're just distributing it. That's it. Everything else is still made by the same people, which is so funny to me. So yeah. Like Destin's from Shang-Chi.
Right. Right.
You know, like.
No, I mean, that's the like, and that's where these narratives get silly, but I do think that there's some version of that. Like I've seen, and this is what I wanted to talk about briefly, and we'll talk about it more in the coming months. And it'll also transition into the conversation with Chip. But I think
if you're going to transition to Doomsday, is that what you're about to do?
Well, yeah. I'm just saying I've seen people highlight that Brand New Day, you know, is this handmade thing, right? Like they're really trying to get back to what we loved about the Raimi films or whatever.
Yeah. I saw
and
your post.
Doomsday is AI slop. Like I've seen that thrown around. There's no basis for that, right? You can talk about what they've been doing practically. You can talk about what they've been putting into it. And I'm not arguing that is in any way true or evidenced by what we're getting from Doomsday. But that is a narrative.
How does anyone even know
that
yet? How does anyone know that yet?
I think it's based on people. I think people see the trailer, and I think people see.
Okay, but even the trailer, what are we talking? We're talking about one shot of Thor attacking Doom? Because the rest of the trailer is like them in the desert shaking hands, them in Xavier's mansion.
But they're actually in the house. I think it's Steve in the house. I think it's a flash of. I think the perception is they're just throwing characters and bits of IP at you and hoping that it sticks and that you want to come and see all of these characters fight each other and that there's not a... Again, I think what Brand New Day did is it found a way to make people, even though it's a movie that's stuffed full of plot lines and characters and MCU references... It makes you think, oh, now this is back to basics. Like, this is what we need. It's almost like playing into the Matt Reeves Batman thing, like a totally different vibe, but a Spider-Man version of that in the marketing. The movie is not that. The movie is very much an MCU film that has Spider-Man in it. And we talked about that as what I viewed as a huge pro of the
movie. But even Avengers hasn't hardly been marketed yet. It's still not till December. So to make the judgment on that is wild to me. We're not there yet.
Right. But I think it is telling on some level that is a conversation, and maybe it's just that people are wanting that to be.
Here we
go. Maybe there are people that just want it to. I think ultimately what I'm curious about.
Next week we're gonna get down with gloves off. We're gonna fight about this. Not you. I'm gonna fight this hypothetical person you're talking about. This theoretical.
Love it. My straw man MCU hater. I think my question going into this December is going to be: do people separate their investment in an Avengers movie from their investment in the MCU leading up to the Avengers movie? Because they can do that for Spider-Man. Can they do that for the Avengers?
Yeah. Okay. So per your point, as some anecdotal evidence, I'm talking to my neighbor Isaac yesterday in the front, and his wife, Megan, friend of mine, is behind the house sitting in a pool. And I hear her say to Isaac, "Is Kyle there? Is Kyle there?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I'm here." So I go to the fence and she's like, "Kyle, I can't stop thinking of Spider-Man." And this is not like, let me paint the picture. This is like a business owner, not a person. Like, this is a cool girl. You know what I mean? Like,
Yeah.
This is not who you would think. And she can't stop thinking about Spider-Man. And she goes on this whole thing about how good it was. And
it was that hot tub scene.
It was the hot tub scene. But she loved it. And this is not an MCU fan. Then I'm playing Warzone last night with my guys. And I went on the tangent. I said, "Guys, I can't believe that Dune Part 3 and Doomsday are releasing on the same day. It's just so mind-blowing to me that they wouldn't move them 1 week apart. And it's not the same as Barbenheimer because those were not the same markets, right? Like, people that went to Oppenheimer now like went to Barbie because it was a thing, and Barbie vice versa because it was a thing. But this is not. This is the movie that you're making people choose that they would see anyways. And my friend, who knows none of this, goes, "Oh, Dune's going to crush Avengers, right?" And the funny, per your point, you're like, that's the perception. And I'm like, what's kind of funny is like Dune Part 2, phenomenal movie, not talking about the quality, you know, like had a movement behind it, made $750 million. And that was like a moment.
Right.
The lowest Avengers movie is Age of Ultron is $1.4 billion. So even if Dune makes 40% more and gets the billion threshold because it's the end of a trilogy and like it's a thing, this would have to be the lowest grossing Avengers movie ever by a long margin just to tie.
Yeah.
And here's a tangent I'm going to go on. And then next week we'll figure this out. I think, Robbie, I would fight somebody on the exact opposite of what you're kind of getting at. And I think it's a little bit the circles we run in our lives, you and I. They're a little bit different circles. I'm not going to make this a political argument, but I want to use this as a way to paint my picture. I think that do you remember how the first time Trump got elected, the whole story was there's literally no way?
Right.
Like, because the media was like, this is ridiculous. And then like slowly as it started happening, it was like this, oh crap, like it might actually happen. It might happen. And that happened. And then everyone was forced to reckon with, how did that happen?
Right.
Well, there was a huge portion of the country that isn't on media that was voting for him. They're not consuming any of this stuff, and they all voted for him, and they're not represented. Yeah. So they voted for him. I'm starting to think, like with what Iman Vellani said with Spider-Man, I'm just starting to think that that's, like, to me, watch Doomsday.
You should say, because people may not know what Iman Vellani said about Spider-Man.
Which is like, the superhero fatigue isn't really real. It's like, I'm now calling out, I'm going to call out media, and I'm going to call out specifically creators of this stuff.
Kyle's calling out the lamestream media.
No, Chip is kind of a fun interview to have on the back part of this conversation because he does still like the movies. He multiple times in this interview is going to say it was fun for him to get invited to a premiere. That's like a bucket list item. But I'm calling out the other creators, and I'm calling out people like Dan, and I'm calling out people like the media. I think we're just past the moment where it's not fun, it's not cool to have to always critique and hate on this stuff. There isn't really a superhero fatigue. It's that you keep talking about it. You keep trying to say there is, but there's a huge underrepresented part of the country that is going to go to Avengers Doomsday. It's still going to make a $1.7 billion despite the people on Twitter saying it has AI slop. There are people that still just want to enjoy it. And I think it's especially bothersome to me that if you're a comic creator, you're a part of this. You should be celebrating it. Otherwise, you don't have a job. If you shoot down people not liking these things because it's not cool, they're not going to buy comics. Stop coming across like it's this like elitist thing that you can't. Like, why do I have to feel weird saying that Spider-Man is good to a comics creator? I feel pressure that they're going to then go, "Oh, come on. You don't really."
Have there been comics creators coming out? The interviews I've seen, people have been like JMS and Frank Miller. I feel like people have been happy about Brand New Day on the comic side.
I'm calming down. I think I'm not talking about one specific thing. You know, like Chip, even in this interview, talks about like that Marvel lost its shine, you know, for a few years, which I mostly agree with. But there's also movies in there that I don't agree with that on, by the way, that I think are over-critiqued.
Yeah.
And I think I'm also referencing Dan last week. And then, like, the online narrative of, like, it's almost becoming, I think, in some ways, like, controversial to say. Or, like, you know, Chip talks about the guy in the car, the cab. That, like, right, there's a right. pressure to almost be like, yeah, I don't know. It's not been very good. It's like you have to say that as, like, to fit in with the crowd.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and that's the part I'm pushing on him back on, because I think, as Iman Vellani said, that there are a bunch of fans of this stuff still. As long as you make a good movie, they'll come out of the woodwork. They're just not the ones that feel confident enough in the cab to go, I freaking love what the MCU is doing right now. I mean, Fantastic Four, Thunderbolts, Spider-Man, Brand New Day are objectively, in my opinion, great films. And
yeah.
made with care and passion and all this stuff. So for someone to say they don't, if you're, like, involved in this and you don't like Thunderbolts, that's just mind-blowing to me. Like, they are doing, and I think people are going to come out of the woodwork, even though they didn't for that. I almost feel like there's an overwhelming pressure for them to not.
Right, right. And I think
okay,
that's
I have to calm down.
I think that's what I'm curious to track over the next couple of months. And Chip does talk about that, like he talks about how Brand New Day shows kind of like what you're saying, Iman said. Like you make a good movie, you make it with care, and people show up, and it doesn't necessarily matter what the genre is. And if you know, it certainly helps if you do that, and it's a character that is beloved and that
and
people
do
like
you,
seeing.
Do you really think at your core, Robbie, that the Russos, Kevin Feige, and Robert Downey Jr., knowing this moment, aren't going to make the movie with care?
No. I'm
but
just saying
that to the people who say that,
right.
The AI slap. Like, do you think they're not going to make it with care? Like, they're 4 for 4 in making movies with care. I mean, Winter Soldier was like,
yeah,
that was the whole thing.
I think
they choreographed the elevator fight scene. That was a big deal.
I think ultimately all of this is going to be to Doomsday's benefit, the conversation around Spider-Man. And even if it puts pressure on Doomsday, I think that the problem with Fantastic Four and Thunderbolts, in addition to, well, no, it's like what I was saying about them being tied to the MCU to some degree, in that I think that there are worse movies that Marvel has made that had more eyes on them earlier in the multiverse saga.
Yeah, yep, 100%.
And by the time we got to these movies, which I think
that's
are
right.
very much on par with the good Infinity Saga movies, the eyes were gone. And how do you get those back? And
that's
maybe
right.
it's Spider-Man.
And it's not their fault, those movies' fault.
Right, and
it
I'm
was
not
the
sure.
prior movies, the prior era's fault.
And I think that's part of why I'm asking this question about Doomsday, because we have seen that play out. Like, we've seen people try to do versions of what they've done with Spider-Man with other properties in the MCU, and it work critically, creatively, but not necessarily commercially on the same level. Now, I don't know that we ever expected Fantastic Four or Thunderbolts to do anywhere near the kind of numbers that we would expect a Spider-Man movie to do, even the other Spider-Man movies. So I'm not trying to say that it like they both massively underperformed or something. I'm just saying those movies came out, they were great, they were handled with care, and a lot of, if you talk to an average person, like when I talk to people in my office, a lot of people are still going to be like, ah, yeah, I mean, I used to love, like, I loved the MCU stuff. Like when Endgame came out, oh my gosh. And then since then they've kind of lost me. And it's like, why? You know, like, why is that? And what is there that Marvel can do or should do?
Are those people in your office now changing their tune?
They're excited. I've talked to people that love Spider-Man. I haven't seen that yet translate to now I'm so stoked for Doomsday. But that's where I think that this is providing some runway, and I'm just curious to see what Marvel does to take advantage of that momentum heading into December.
Yeah, if there was going to be some kind of, in a healthy way, reactionary moment to that moment, like meaning if they were going to do stuff, it's probably going to have to be in Secret Wars more than it is in Doomsday. Like my thing is like most of the writing and the visual aspect and stuff is probably already locked in, you know, for Doomsday. So if they quote unquote, if people think that Marvel learned lessons from the success of Brand New Day, you're probably not going to reap the benefits until Secret Wars, unfortunately, if that's the case.
Unless the lessons to be learned are less on the filmmaking side, because we've already seen them handle recent projects that way, and more on the marketing and how they
and on the filmmaking side, that's more the counter to what I just said. I would think that, like, this whole idea of Marvel slowing down the Disney Plus content and like really pouring into artful movies, that already began like a year and a half ago, right? Like, in some ways, Marvel's actually ahead of some of those streaming questions, because they're now, they have hit the brakes like crazy before other companies hit the brakes. Don't you think like a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, like pre-Thunderbolts, is when you started hearing Kevin going, we're going to go back to making like one quality movie or whatever. So in that way, Doomsday probably already does have some of this. Like, I would imagine Doomsday already has like as much on like sets and locations as possible and less green screen, I would imagine.
That's what I've read. That
I would imagine that there's some like heightened dialogue. Like, that's their thing. The people writing Doomsday, the whole team involved with Doomsday is, you know, obviously the Russos, Kevin Feige, and Robert Downey Jr. I'm sure they speak into some of the writing. But then it's written by McFeely, who, you know, we trust. And then they brought in Summers and McKenna from Spider-Man Brand New Day and Michael Waldron.
Yeah.
So to me, that's another part that's like, it'd be really hard for me to think that they just, the four of them are going, let's just do like a slot movie, like insert green screen fight battle.
Right.
They're, Michael Waldron, if anybody, is probably going to be pushing for the opposite of like, let's have like a heightened conversation in this room. I don't know. So like, part of me thinks like,
that's right.
I don't think there's any way they're like, yeah, just green screen this at this moment in time. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I think again,
and obviously more of it has to be green screen, obviously.
Yeah. And I think that there is a weirdness around the MCU in this kind of vague sense where I think, like, again, like, and this can actually transition into chapter.
Yeah, okay, sorry, I'm done. I'm officially done.
We've talked about this some over the years on the comic side, and I think that it's finally being recognized in a real way. You had this era from roughly 2004 to 2015 when Marvel Comics was just so, like, it was a like an electric thing where there was this through line running through it all. It felt so much like what I think people view the Infinity Saga as, where there's an ongoing story and you have separate stories that all stand on their own. Like, you look at the, you know, whether it's phase one or phase two, where you have Winter Soldier over here doing great stuff that sets up parts of Age of Ultron. You can still enjoy it on its own without Age of Ultron, but it kind of feels like all of this, they all serve each other, you know? And then I think that we have had a moment in the multiverse saga where, for a variety of reasons, it's become less clear what relationship any one project has to another and 100%. Why they all need to exist or should exist in the same universe or don't or whatever. And I have always thought that, really ever since the Secret Wars event that Hickman did in 2015, Marvel Comics has been in a similar mode where they had this Bendis era followed up by this Hickman era where it really felt like if you were reading the Avengers, you were tracking with the Marvel Universe and you would read the events that spun out of that. And then maybe you also see this other character and want to go read whether it's Spider-Man or X-Men or whatever that's kind of coming in and crossing through that. And then after Secret Wars, it was done so well and it was done so definitively that it's why I've always said in some ways it maybe would have been easier if Marvel had just reset the universe after that, because it was so hard to ever regain that sense of momentum. And I think the result is we have a lot kind of like the Multiverse Saga. And the years since then, on the comic side, we've had a lot of really great runs. Like Chip's Daredevil run was excellent. Al Ewing's Immortal Hulk run was excellent. We saw like the end of Jason Aaron's Thor, which was excellent. But in terms of a center thing, I think that that's felt lacking. And you've had, again, like the X-Men, I should say, like the Hickman Krakoa stuff was huge and kind of became its own driving thing, which is kind of funny looking at the direction of the MCU now. But it still felt like that was an X-Men universe. It didn't feel like the Marvel universe. And I think what Bendis did that was so genius was merging all of that stuff and bringing Wolverine and Spider-Man into the Avengers and making that feel like it's the center point. I think what's fun about what Chip is doing and what he's coming on to talk about is he is launching a new Avengers book that is set to release in conjunction with Doomsday or around that time later this fall. And he's currently writing Avengers Armageddon, which is an event that's kind of born out of his Captain America run and another miniseries that came and that was sort of born out of what Ryan North did with a One World Under Doom event last year. But Chip is, I think, as you'll hear, passionate about trying to restore that and is wanting to bring that sense of kind of unity within the Marvel Comics universe that has felt is lacking, and also the excitement and that feeling that this is the one book that you can't miss. Like, this is the book that is going to drive everything. And so we talk about what goes into that and how Chip decided which characters need to belong and which characters, he enjoys writing and how Spider-Man fits into that. And it's a fun conversation, both for what it says, I think, about the state of the superhero conversation generally, what it says about what it means to have universes like this that you can keep people invested in. And we have some fun Spider-Man talk because as we mentioned a couple episodes ago, Chip is one of the creators that gets the shout out at the end of Brand New Day and the credits. And he went to the premiere and visited the set for this as well as for Fantastic Four. So it's a fun conversation that touches on, from a different perspective, on really everything that we've been talking about here. And to your point, it's always nice to talk to Chip because he is a very thoughtful creator, but also a genuine fan.
Yeah, and a positive force.
Yeah, yeah. And so you see kind of what it does look like to be someone that's working on a lot of these things that have been, are being adapted, and is passionate about making them the best they can be. So I think for anyone that is curious about anything that we just covered, you will enjoy this conversation with Chip Zdarsky.
Yep. So next week, more of this, more of our Spider-Man reflection, and more of the D23 news. It'll be really exciting. And if you want the full length version of this Chip Zdarsky interview, Chip actually hung out for like over an hour. So if you want even more, go to our YouTube page or go to Friends from Work Plus to get the full interview from Chip. We'll be back with the Chip interview after a quick word from these sponsors. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. All right, you've heard me talk about BetterHelp for a long time, but I don't know that we've actually ever talked about how much people really love this service when they use it. But good news, you don't have to take my word for it. In fact, if you go to betterhelp.com/reviews, you can see countless amazing customer reviews in real time. And they constantly update these reviews like every day, and sometimes like literally hundreds of people saying how much they love BetterHelp and how helpful it's been to them. So again, just hop over to betterhelp.com/reviews to see for yourself. And if you need another reminder, let me remind you that more than 6 million people have used BetterHelp globally. And because they have that consistent feedback from real users, it makes it really easy to see why so many people continue to choose BetterHelp. And if those reviews aren't enough for you, well, BetterHelp makes it really easy to get started. All you got to do is go to betterhelp.com, answer a few questions, and they will match you with a therapist based on your answers and your needs. And here's the other thing. If it's not working out for some weird reason, you can switch therapists at any time. Again, any time if it's not the right fit. So see it for yourself. Go see the reviews, see what stands out, and see if BetterHelp is right for you. Visit betterhelp.com. That's better, H-E-L-P.com.
Well, let's give a warm welcome back to Friends from Work, the writer of comics like Batman, Daredevil, Spider-Man, Life Story, and soon, The Avengers, Whoa. Chip Zdarsky.
Hey, how's it going?
how's your day going?
Oh, man. Doing a lettering pass on Avengers number one. So that's, you know, that's the point where I'm just like, is this any good? I hope it's good. Maybe I can change a couple of words to make it good.
How much leeway do you have at that point with edits?
I mean, it's an interesting process because you write the script and then the artist goes and draws it. And kind of in that process, sometimes what they draw doesn't line up with your text, really. Like if a character's not screaming on panel, but in the dialogue is screaming, or characters are kind of like placed in a weird way where your dialogue isn't going to fit. There's all sorts of things that can crop up. So like it's like a not a total rewrite, but it's definitely gives it a totally different flavor once the art's in and you're like, oh, this doesn't work the way I thought it would, or it works better, just a couple small tweaks here and there. So it's interesting just to hit this stage of the project.
Do you ever find yourself, because I feel like you've worked with such a wide variety of artists or artists with a variety of styles.
Yeah.
Do you visualize a scene one way in your head and then you see it come back, not just in terms of the structure of it, but you know, the artists are kind of doing the acting as well. And so does that ever kind of reveal something that you didn't know the scene could be doing? Or is it something that you realize it maybe can't do that you thought it could?
I mean, great artists will show me a way to do it better for sure. And then it'll come back like, oh, okay, that's a much better take on that. I put a lot of kind of visual direction in my scripts, like kind of calling shots and angles and expressions and things, placement of characters. When I first started writing for other artists, it was at Marvel, and it freaked me out because I'd have a full visual in my head as I was writing, and then the pages would come back and be like, that's not what I had in my head. And sometimes it'd be better and sometimes it'd be worse, but it was still just jarring, right? I'm better now at not locking in an idea, I think, when I'm writing. Like I write in such a way that I know it works on the page. Like I know what I'm asking isn't impossible and that it should look fine. But I don't keep a strong visual in my head when I go to send it off because that way lies madness, it turns out.
Well, you have now worked quite a lot with Marco. So yeah. When it comes to something like Avengers, you probably have a better idea of what he's going to give you.
And you know, I mean, we both know each other's strengths and weaknesses, so we can play to them a lot easier. Not that he has any weaknesses. His only weakness is he can't draw unattractive people.
That is true.
Every time I try in a script to say that someone isn't a supermodel, they still somehow come back as a supermodel. But yeah, it definitely helps having a longer relationship with the artist because you do get to know each other and strengths and weaknesses, things like that. But it's also like we've been dating other people, right? Like we went our separate ways and we've been sleeping around and now we come back together and it's like, oh, okay, we have to kind of relearn each other a little bit again, I think.
Yeah. I mean, how do you follow up on the ultimate experience?
Exactly. If you will. Exactly. But also he went from Daredevil, which is, you know, a solo character, to Ultimate Spider-Man, which was a solo character, but kind of really revolved around obviously the family and secondary characters. And now he's it's Avengers, which is a very different thing. Like, you know, I do feel bad for him. Like, I'm giving him cool stuff to draw, but it's a lot. Like, it really is a lot. And I think he's feeling that. And I have to dial it back a little bit. I definitely have to give him, like, an issue where it's just, like, one character wondering where the rest of the Avengers are. Just to be kind.
I know you wrote an Invaders series. And, you know, you wrote the FF 2-in-1. And there are certainly team aspects to books. Even the Daredevil book has some, towards the end, team flavors.
Yeah, for sure.
But I feel like you have generally, in my mind, I associate you more with solo books. What has that, have you found that it's a whole different animal balancing a book that is really, it is nominally focused on a team and not a one central character?
I do feel like I've had just enough practice to be ready for this. Because like you said, like Invaders and, you know, the FF X-Men crossover I did was like, it was juggling a lot of characters. Like I know I have it in me to juggle characters. The more challenging part really on this has been, I guess kind of figuring out the powers, weirdly. I know it sounds very, very detail oriented, but like in a fight scene, like you want to keep it visually interesting. And so it's trying to figure out combinations of powers and, uses for each of the characters, that isn't, you know, boring or it's been done too many times. You know, we're not going to do a bunch of fastball specials, you know, like it's, you gotta pick and choose kind of like how you kind of utilize these powers. And one of the interesting things too, is like the way the team itself came together was not very planned, in the sense that like, I always found it weird when superhero teams were like, we've got a strong guy, we have someone who flies, and we've got a psychic. Like they kind of fit all these superpower kind of archetypes for the most part,
right?
In the planning, even if the characters like come together randomly in the book, I'm like, oh, I don't know about that. But for this, it kind of really kind of stemmed from both the story I was telling through Avengers Armageddon and lead up, and also Marco's desire to draw certain characters. So I'm like, okay, well, you know, he loves Spider-Man, so I had to put Spider-Man there. Daredevil was a no-brainer as well, because obviously we have the history of the character. But then everything else kind of stemmed from story. And also in the back of my mind, just like, I kind of want to see how Marco draws these characters, because he makes everyone look, again, insanely cool. Right. So, you know, I want to see a big fight scene with Logan and Carol and Luke. You know, Spidey and Daredevil. It just, yeah, as a fan, it kind of, it tickles me to see that on the page, right?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like there's a reason why Marco's gotten so much cover work at Marvel. I think the only problem with that is it's really hard for any artist to follow up on the promise of that cover.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. He's too damn good. That's the problem.
But it's great for your book.
I'm very lucky.
And I'm glad you talked about Armageddon, or mentioned Armageddon, because that's kind of where I wanted to start.
Yeah.
When you came on last time, you had just launched the Captain America book. And, you know, that is obviously still going strong. Seems to be expanding, you know, because we had Weapons of Armageddon, and that led into the Armageddon event, which is going on right now.
Yeah.
I was curious, when did you get the idea for Avengers Armageddon? And was that something that you had in mind from the start of your Captain America run? Or is that something that kind of came up organically later in that process?
I had the germ of it in mind for the Captain America run, like it felt like I was building up to this bigger kind of Ross story, and I kind of knew a lot of the pieces for that. In my mind, it was going to take place in Captain America, but then what happened was Will Moss, the editor at Marvel, offered me Avengers with a very specific start date, which coincided with the opening of a certain Avengers movie. So I was like, I debated it, obviously, because, you know, there's only so many hours in the day, but a few ideas kind of came into my head that kind of tied a lot of things I was working on together. And I was like, oh, this would be perfect, actually, because I can tie in a lot of Captain America stuff and lay down tracks for some kind of future things I want to do. So at that point, I was like, well, I need to clear the decks for this Avengers series. Like, I can't just inherit Jed's lineup and just kind of make it business as usual because I've got these ideas in mind. So the Captain America story just kind of became bigger then and turned into Avengers Armageddon as kind of a way to kind of like do a bit of a reset, you know, similar to what Bendis did with Avengers Disassemble. Just kind of like, okay, we got to shake things up just so we can like hit the ground running with a new number one. So it's not just like, hey, the Avengers are back. New team, like, we don't want just that. There's got to be a reason for it. There's got to be a mix up there.
That's it's funny. You just landed on one of the things I was going to ask you about, and one of the comments that we got from a patron.
Okay,
Jan the Man. It's a two parter here. One's a question. One's a comment. Back to the question. All right. So. He said to let you know that, quote, he's done an amazing job at recapturing the spark of the Marvel stories I love from the 2000s.
Yeah, cool.
And I will say, I feel like there's been a lot of talk kind of comparing you coming on with this event and the new Avengers team to the period when Bendis' new Avengers launched, just in that it seems to be It seems to maybe be a unifying force in a way that I think has been absent from the Marvel Comics universe for a bit.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because, like, somebody was saying, maybe, I don't know, this is going back a year or so ago, maybe longer, they're saying if they were, if they're going to read a Marvel book to find out what's happening in Marvel, what book was that? And I didn't have an answer for them because, you know, everything's kind of siloed off a little bit, you know, X-Men, Spider-Man, Avengers kind of books, street level books, things like that. But there wasn't really a book that was kind of driving the overall narrative of the universe. Like, Bendis was really good at that, obviously. Jonathan Hickman obviously is good at that as well. But it just felt like there needs to be a title where you go to it just to find out kind of the overarching story of the Marvel Universe.
Yeah.
That other titles can play with if they want to or not. So that felt like a pretty, like, not the gauntlet was thrown down, but like that was kind of the challenge kind of I put for myself, especially once Avengers was offered to me. I was just like, okay, how do we make it so Avengers is the book you have to read? And so we're doing things, like, I've got several arcs planned out. I'm just like, oh, no, people have to read this. Like, it's going to be cool. It's going to be big. It's going to affect other things. Like, with some really neat moments and beautiful art. And it's like, okay, this is the book. And the Bendis comparison, I think, is pretty apt. It's funny because, it just again, like, the way the team on the book came together just felt very random to me. But obviously, looking at it, I'm like, oh yeah, no, that's very similar vibes to Bendis's Avengers. It just kind of worked out that way.
But, you know, I think I also feel like there are some comparisons you could make to Jed's Avengers and and the teams that preceded Bendis.
For sure.
Where, you know, there maybe it's a reaction, but yeah, I think that we talk about that a lot when people are trying to get into comics and get into Marvel Comics specifically, and they ask me where they should start. I frequently point people to Avengers Disassembled or Breakout, just because from there you can, you're right, you can launch into all those big events from the 2000s, but you can also easily kind of weave from that into the parts of the JMS Spider-Man run. You can weave into the Brubaker Daredevil stuff. You can weave into Whedon's X-Men, like all of this stuff that is, that's aged pretty well was, they all functioned on their own and you can go read those books on their own, but they also dovetail really gracefully. It was a, I think it was a period that made it really fun to read Marvel comics.
Yeah. Yeah. They, you can start with issue one, not get lost. It's its own thing, but it also reflected what was happening in the rest of the Marvel line. Like it wasn't contradicting anything, which is nice. I think that's the way these kind of universes should operate.
Yeah. Well, and talking about the Armageddon piece and the connection to Avengers, the other part of Jan's comment question was, he said he'd love to know where you came up with the idea of David Colton, which I think to me is sort of a two-part question, because I wonder if there is a version of Colton that existed prior to Armageddon and a version that existed post Armageddon, and that we're obviously seeing that character evolve now.
Yeah, we're along on his journey. One of the things about working for Marvel or DC for that matter is the characters have all been through so much. And they've learned so much from each of those experiences. It's hard for them to continue to have flaws or things that they're blind to. You know, we try, obviously, you know, you kind of, it's the argument. It's like, well, why doesn't Spider-Man grow up or whatever? It's like, well, if you keep going down a certain line, then you just have like a really capable, smart, funny, unflawed character. Which, you know, there's some fulfillment there, but, I think people get bored of that pretty quickly. Like you don't want all your characters to end up being perfect. So, you know, we do our best to kind of make sure there's some resets that happen here and there, and stay true to what kind of makes the character interesting to people. But a great way around that is bring in a new character. Like David Colton is flawed and he has a different take than maybe the other Marvel characters. That makes him really interesting for me to kind of to write. And I'm able to take him on a bit of an accelerated journey as a result of that, which has been fun.
Yeah. I think of that as kind of the Ted Lasso problem, where by the later seasons of that show, All of the folks around him have been so influenced by him that it's just people constantly saying very kind and affirming things to each other.
Everyone loves each other. There's no tension there. Yeah, I mean, that is the tricky part, right? Like, you need tension for a story to be good, to really engage the reader. And, you know, when these characters have, like, you know, 70-year histories or something, that's really hard. It's hard to kind of keep that... to keep that fresh.
Yeah. When you were looking at Armageddon and the way that eventually connects to Avengers, I was struck in that first issue that you make a point to show Spider-Man not going out on that initial, you know, invasion or incursion or I don't know why I'm picking two different Jonathan Hickman
ultimate, some sort of a secret war that they're having overseas.
but he then has a very pronounced moment in Captain America in the most recent issue or the one before. As you're kind of looking at the different characters that are involved there, I'm sure there's part of that has to work to kind of tee up what we're going to get in the Avengers book.
Yeah.
But is that also something where you're kind of trying to look at which of these characters would feel comfortable being engaged in something that feels a little bit more warlike and which would not?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Like those two things kind of worked well together for me because it does tee Spidey up for Avengers and also it works with the character. He's the friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. Like obviously he's had, you know, globe spanning and interstellar adventures and stuff. But again, to get back to the heart of the character, you've got to be like, yeah, but he's still like, he wants to help just regular people. And he also sees this kind of like this push against Ross where it's the right thing to do, but also it's like it's founded on a lot of anger and maybe that's not the way this should be done. And Spider-Man's one of those characters that's always kind of, you know, in trouble with the law, very cognizant of it. And he kind of sees this happening on an international level. He's like, okay, like if you guys call me in, like I'll come, but like, it feels like you've got this. So I can handle all the problems left at home because no one's going to be here. Like right. If we're clearing New York out of superheroes, someone's got to be here. So that kind of worked well with, again, what kind of happens later on, Spidey's feelings about the Avengers.
Yeah, there's a moment in the Infinity War movie that always stuck out to me, especially early on because we just hadn't really seen Spider-Man outside of his own isolated universe much.
Yeah.
But they're all fighting Thanos and they make a point to show that he's the one that is, you know, catching the other Guardians when they're flying off. And it's kind of this, mm-hmm. like his first instinct is more towards protecting folks than it is towards the kind of more aggressive
and attacking. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a great character moment. Yeah.
And I think that winds up being highlighted really well in that Cap hospital scene, which is one of my favorite Spider-Man scenes we've gotten in a while.
Oh, thanks.
Which again, you know, you always kind of sneak those moments in, like with the Daredevil, several of the Daredevil Spidey scenes.
It's always easier to kind of like write characters as guest stars. Weirdly, because you can just kind of drop them in these like kind of perfect little beats. You know, harder to kind of do that in a sustained way, I think.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, that's why Spider-Man's the moral center of the Marvel Universe. Like, he's the reader. He goes where the reader goes. Civil War is the perfect example of that, right? Like, he was the one that was on kind of neither side, and then all of a sudden he's with Tony Stark, and then, oh, in the end, he realizes that's not the right move and switches it up. He is the Marvel Universe. There's a reason he's so popular and everyone loves him and everyone relates to him.
Which, you know, I mean, that is, it's a good time to be having that conversation, I guess.
Yeah, totally.
As the Spider-Man movie is
doing well.
You know, we've been covering these movies basically since Endgame came out. We started the podcast midway through 2019, and then
a very funny time to start a Marvel like an MCU based podcast.
I know.
All right, know. They're wrapping up.
but you know what? Then everything shut down, and everybody just wanted to movie marathon stuff
the
time.
It's true.
So there were so many people that I think had never seen all of that stuff. And then they went back through which is part of the reason why I think when WandaVision came out, there were so many folks that were kind of primed to jump in.
Yeah.
But in all of that, you know, I don't think anybody ever thought that we would be approaching anything like the pre-pandemic numbers. I mean, because Avengers Endgame was such a unique animal for a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
And it is wild seeing that. I mean, this movie is not crazy far from some of those numbers.
Yeah, it's wild, and like, it's cool seeing people kind of come up to those movies again. Like, it just kind of goes to show you, you know, make really good movies and it'll work. Not that, you know, Marvel hasn't made good movies since Endgame, but there is a lot of repetition there for sure.
Yeah,
and I think they recognize that. It's funny because I went to LA for the Spider-Man premiere, which was fun. But like the day or so before, whenever I catch a ride or, you know, Uber or whatever, taxi, I'd always talk to the driver and just like kind of see where they're at with the Marvel stuff. And they're almost all the same. Like, yeah, I used to, but then, yeah, I kind of fell off. And I'm like, oh, like after Endgame? He's like, yeah, kind of after Endgame, you know.
Yeah.
You know, so while, and then, you know, they'll like have kind of dim memories of some, confuse some with others.
Right.
Like, you know, I was talking to a guy last night and he was like trying to describe the last couple of Marvel movies he saw, and he was like, he was mixing them all up, and I'm just like, yeah, there's so many, like, and you know, you really want them to be distinct enough that you don't mix them up. Like, I wouldn't mix up
right
Logan with, you know, Avengers Endgame. Like, they're very distinct movies.
Right,
but yeah, so it's interesting just kind of hearing people talk about it, like engaging with them and just seeing like, oh, okay, where is everyone at with the MCU stuff? And like, they want to like them.
Mm-hmm.
They just need to be given more things that really feel unique. And like, and Brand New Day feels unique. Like, even though it's got like a lot of like, you know, some tropes here and there and, you know, some kind of Marvel visuals that have kind of been a mainstay. I mean, the director did a lot of interesting things with it, that like visually, which you don't get as much of that really with the Marvel stuff.
Yeah.
I find. Yeah.
Well, and I think that at least the attempt to ground it more in practical effects where they could.
Yeah.
Does a lot visually and, you know, we've talked about this some on the podcast. I think in all fairness that Thunderbolts tried to do that as well. And I think Fantastic Four did as well, though, you know, to varying degrees. And Galactus is, you know, a giant planet-sized being. But
yeah.
But even then, you know, there were elements of that were practically grounded. But I think that Brand New Day is a movie that, a Spider-Man movie is going to get eyes in a way that others don't, and it does seem to be emphasizing the fact that when you try to take a unique or try to take a specific approach rather to kind of tailor your approach to the movie that you're making rather than have an approach that you then fit the movie to.
Yeah.
I did notice that you were credited as one of the comics creator folks.
The special thanks. Yeah.
The special thanks crew.
Yeah.
You know, I know that you were included for at least Born Again and Fantastic Four, and I'm maybe missing others, but no, I've always been curious. When do you learn that you will be in that group?
I think it's different depending on the project. Depending on the creator and what their current relationship with Marvel is too, I think. Daredevil was funny. Like, I found out that because season one of Born Again, they had a character Marco and I created, Cole North, in it. And so I found that out at New York Comic Con when I was on the floor, and my editor texted me and saying, hey, come meet me over at Marco's table or whatever. And like, I walk over and like, and he introduces me to Cole North. I'm like, what? Like, that's so weird. I mean, at that point I kind of know, like, I'm going to be in the credits. And so I don't officially know that until like maybe a couple weeks before the premiere, in which Marvel kind of offers me, to come to the premiere and a sum of money for my expenses and as a special thank you, and it's great. it's fantastic. And, you know, I had the thing where I was like, at the end of season one, like Cole North gets blown up. And I was just like, God right. damn it. Like, I could have really used another check for season two. And then, you know, a couple months pass or whatever. And then the actor who plays Cole, he texted me just a photo of him in a makeup chair with just like the slight kind of burn marks on his face. I'm like, yes.
Yep.
He survived the explosion. God bless comic book logic. Which meant, you know, another thank you and another trip to New York to go to the premiere. And that stuff's just, I love it. It's just super fun. The Fantastic Four one was wildly confusing. I think basically, like, so they, Marvel Studios kind of decided to make a really concerted effort to, like, you know, honor the comics. Mm-hmm. And so they brought a lot of comic creators who were associated with Fantastic Four to the set at Pinewood when they were filming it. And because I did Marvel 2 and 1, which was kind of like Fantastic Four, it was the only Fantastic Four book at the time, I think I right. managed to squeak in under the wire on that one. And the fact that I'm currently at Marvel, I think they're just like, you know, they prioritize you if, you know, they want to make you happy. You know, makes sense. And so, you know, I went to the set visit and it was fantastic. And I had a great time. And like all the physical stuff was really, really cool. And Pedro Pascal became my best friend. And sure. great. It was a great time. And so as a result of that, I got invited to the premiere. I'm like, okay. I'm like, I've never been to one of those before, like a big movie premiere. So like, you know, my wife joined me, even though she doesn't really watch the stuff or care about comics. And, you know, we did it up all nice and pretty and watch the movie, and at the end, like, I'm in the special thanks. I'm like, they didn't use anything from my stuff. Like, I was only on that for like 12 issues. Made no sense to me. And afterwards, I was quizzing everyone I could find at Marvel, like, why am I in the credits? And no one could figure it out until somebody said, oh, like, basically anyone who went to the set is thanked in the credits. Like, the creators. And I think it's kind of automatically just kind of like did that for you. And I'm like, oh, great. I mean, that's amazing. So I'm like, fantastic. And, you know, I've signed an NDA, so I can't really talk about it, even though the movie's out. But I did visit the Spider-Man set as well. And okay. So that's why I'm thanked in that, too. Because, I watched the movie. I'm like, I don't think anything I've done is in here.
So I was going to ask if you're watching that thinking, not necessarily looking for specific things, but if you are tracking.
I mean, with that one, it was on the set. Like I'm on the set and they're explaining stuff to us and I'm walking around looking at things. I'm like, is any of this? I think all the creators are doing that. Any of us who are right. on the set, I was like, is this from me? I don't know. I think I'm just like, I'm extraordinarily lucky. Really, that I happen to be working on these characters enough to get me an invite, and therefore that invite means I get to go to the premiere. So that's fun.
I will say at some point someone told me that Creden had mentioned reading your Spectacular stuff.
Yeah, there was some sort of interview where he mentioned, my Spectacular books. But like, you know, I can't, there's nothing from the movie that I can see is from that.
I guess the kind of more grounded, you know, I thought the same thing. I mean, so much of the movie, again, it's hilarious to me because this movie is going to wind up making so much money. No Way Home was a massive success. And
yeah.
Those adapted some of the weirdest, most controversial Spider-Man
stories
in the history of comics. I would not have had the other on my bingo card.
I know.
But here we are. So I was thinking, though, you know, when your Spectacular run first hit, I remember I wasn't even really reading comics at the time. I had read a lot growing up, and then I feel like a lot of people do, kind of drifted out and then wound up coming back. And that was around the time I came back in. And I remember having felt like I just didn't really have a hook for Spider-Man. You know, I had read Amazing Spider-Man growing up, a lot of the classic stuff. I had read portions of the JMS stuff that was coming out when I was like of comic reading age initially. Mm-hmm. And then I would look and I just couldn't really figure out how to get reintroduced to the character and kind of, I just assumed all these crazy things had happened to him that I would no longer really be able to keep up with. Mm-hmm. And I think that was maybe the first time I ever saw your name. And I was so glad to know that there was a book that was doing what your spectacular book did. And it does seem a bit like that's what they were trying to do here on some level with Brand New Day.
Yeah, no, it's funny you mention that because like my Spectacular Spider-Man book existed because of Tom Holland's first Spider-Man movie, Homecoming. Because that that movie was set to come out, and Marvel, Dan Slott was writing Amazing Spider-Man still, and Marvel kind of looked, and they were just like, "Oh, like Dan is writing Peter Parker as the head of Parker Industries, and he's like globetrotting CEO who's also fighting crime. We've got a movie coming out where it's Spider-Man in New York, and he's like a jokey, hard on his luck kind of teen. We need something that scratches that itch for those movie viewers. So they don't get confused as hell. Walk into the comic shop afterwards, you know, in this fantasy world where they go immediately to the comic shop. But,
hey, I saw that Damage Control is showing up in the pages of, Joe Kelly's, ASM.
I think he planned that well before knowing any of the Brand New Day stuff, which is really funny. Like, yeah, these things kind of work for us and against us, because sometimes you'll be working on a thing and then you'll watch like a Marvel movie and you'll be like, oh, god damn, people are gonna think I'm a hack now because like I did a similar thing. I've got a couple of those moments, but like but yeah, so that Spectacular run was because of the movie to kind of give people a Peter Parker that felt a bit more familiar, and kind of contain it a little bit so you can hit issue one, understand everything, and kind of, I mean, I try that with every series I'm working on.
Yeah.
Like, cause you don't want to alienate readers, but yeah, very specifically that was for that movie. So yeah, that's funny that now the Brand New Day thing is kind of like full circle, I guess.
Yeah. It's comics imitating movies, imitating comics. Yeah.
The director reading the book that was actually inspired by the first of these movies. Like, so he can do his new movie. Yeah.
But I think back on the tone of some of those kind of villain run-ins that I'm sure intentionally felt a little bit more classic, in that you would have villains that Spider-Man would fight in one or two issues, and then he would move on and inevitably they would break out of jail or whatever and he would fight them again.
Classic.
And we were talking about that with the movie. I think what's kind of crazy is we've never actually had the ability to see that in a Spider-Man movie, because generally it's here's this threat and then at the end of the movie they either die or they go away forever and then you have another movie and a new villain.
Yeah, you get little weird one-offs like Paul Giamatti as the Rhino, you know, these guys just kind of show up.
That's true.
But yeah, no, it was so close to kind of reading a couple issues of the comic, right? Like Spider-Man in New York, you know, montage of him fighting these maybe lesser villains, all the stuff.
Tarantula and Tombstone. And
Boomerang or whatever. Like it was just so fun and cool and felt like a proper New York Spider-Man. Every scene where he's just chatting with somebody who's a civilian or just, you know, or Gene DeWolf or, you know, Damage Control. It's just like, I mean, Tom Holland nailed it. Just the physicality of that performance, the awkwardness and the, just that feeling of Spider-Man was just so perfect.
I know it's, I feel like it's like the Chekhovian Gene DeWolf, though. I'm just.
Yeah. Poor Gene DeWolf.
Right.
Real ones, no.
I was glad to see how much it, but there's a lot of talk of how things are adapted and how much they look pulled from a comic book, but it does seem like both because of the, like some of the visual stuff where they were obviously homaging comic book covers, but also the feel of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I think this is the first time that for me, the MCU has ever, or maybe it's the closest it's ever come to feeling like the Marvel Comics universe.
Yeah.
In the way characters can kind of almost casually bump into each other.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to feel like a big moment.
Yeah.
Normally, I feel like in the movies, when a character walks in, it's sort of like, and now the character walks in.
Yep. Yeah,
and it's a
true
cameo.
Yeah.
But here, you know, like seeing Spider-Man and the Hulk and the Punisher and all of that kind of just making sense.
Yeah, and Yelena, and like, yeah, it's great. It's great. I love it.
In the context of, now that you've written Spider-Man and a lot of versions of Spider-Man, both in kind of in-universe solo books and in, well, now in a team book, how does that change the way that you approach a character like that, who I think is always sort of, there's this tension because, like you said earlier, he is the Marvel Universe. And I was just rereading Mark Waid and Javier Rodriguez's History of the Marvel Universe, which I hadn't read in forever, and it's such a beautiful book. And
yeah,
Waid ends it with the great power and great responsibility quote from Galactus, and very kind of Mark Waid moment. It is he is the center of the Marvel Universe, but he's also kind of has to be a bit of an outsider for the character to work, at least in the way that he was originally designed to.
Yeah, exactly.
He can't be Captain America or Iron Man or Reed Richards.
Yeah.
So what does it mean for you to incorporate that character into a team book, and how does that alter your approach to writing him?
It doesn't work. Like, that's kind of the beauty of it, right? Like, because him, especially in the position he's at with this Avengers team, he's calling some of the shots, and like, he's right and he's wrong. He's Spider-Man, so it doesn't always go well. But unlike other heroes where, you know, if it doesn't go well, they soldier on, like he beats himself up and like maybe spirals, and like, you know, there's
right.
There's always gonna be Spider-Man. Like, just because I put him in the Avengers doesn't make him any less Spider-Man. But he's such a great character to play off of others, because not just the quips, but he's relatively normal compared to everyone. Like he feels like, again, he's like a reader substitute in some ways. So he's the one that's going to be like, wow, that's crazy when something wild happens. Whereas everyone else would be like, all right, let's tackle the crazy thing. He's like, whoa, did you see what just happened? Like,
right.
And, you know, he shouldn't be like that because, he's been in the comics long enough, and then that universe, he's seen everything. But, like, you have to kind of have that element to Spidey for it to work. But also, he's the most powerful character out of all of them in a weird way. Like, there are a lot of references, you know, over the history of the character where people underestimate him. Like, oh, wow, that guy who, you know, knows every punch that's coming, that can dodge them quite easily, and can throw a truck at me, like, he's actually... he's not a street level character. Like, we associate him with that, but like, you know, he's, you know, above and beyond, just in terms of the power set, most of the Marvel characters, weirdly.
I think is it in Secret Wars, the original Secret Wars, when he the basically X-Men? Beats up the entire X-Men?
Yeah. That was my first introduction to the character. I was just like, whoa, like, do you see what he did? And all the X-Men were like, we just got beat up by Spider-Man? And, you know, shortly after that, like, I was reading, I think it was Amazing Spider-Man 270, something like that, where, like, like Fire Lord, who's like one of Galactus's heralds, comes to Earth, and it's just like, is this unstoppable force? And Spider-Man is just like trying to stay one step ahead of him the whole time, and then he just snaps and he's just like, no, I'm done, and just beats the hell out of him. And everyone's like, Spider-Man did this? I'm like, yeah, Spider-Man did this. As a kid, you're just like, this is the coolest thing ever, because he doesn't know it, right? Like, he doesn't have the ego to be like, I'm actually, you know, I'm stronger than all these guys, so I should be in charge. Like, he doesn't have that at all, which makes him really fun to write.
Yeah. That was one of the fun things about Slott's Superior run, is kind of seeing that power set without any of the guardrails, which then kind of paints Peter himself in sharper relief. And I think informs that character more moving forward.
Yeah. Otto understood the power that he had, which makes him incredibly dangerous. For sure.
I feel like you at some point have written all these characters, at least a bit, maybe not as much Captain Marvel, in the context of the team. Have you found one that you enjoy writing the most, that's easier to write?
Spider-Man is always going to be easy, just because, like, I've written him so much. But Carol's been really fun, because you're right, I haven't had a chance to write Carol that much, and I kind of knew she was the one I really wanted to inherit through, you know, kind of previous Avengers runs, and especially in the position we have her post Armageddon, it just makes her a really interesting character. And I can't give too much away, but her and Luke's dynamic, because they're both leaders, is really interesting as well. I wanted Luke in there kind of mostly because I feel like I let Luke down. Like, I made him mayor, and then didn't do anything with it. I was like, and partly because, like, I made him mayor, and then there were some plans that were going to happen with other writers, and it's going to be like some Luke Cage series, and, for some reason, like, none of them quite got off the ground. And by that point, I was already off Daredevil. And so I was overdoing Batman. So I didn't really take advantage of Luke as mayor, and I don't think anyone really did. Like, you know, if you needed the mayor in the comic, it would be Luke Cage, and that's kind of the extent of it. There were a couple beats here and there, like Thunderbolt stuff.
That's a good point.
I felt like, you know, there was a lot to mine from him as mayor. And no one really kind of picked that up. So I'm like, with the Avengers, I'm like, oh, now here's my chance. It's a team book. It's New York. I can put Luke Cage on it and kind of rectify that for myself anyways.
This came up some as we were talking about Daredevil Born Again season 2, which, one, I was glad to see that Cole North made it to season 2. But then the whole time I was thinking, there still has to be, I don't know. Sometimes you have characters included in comic book adaptations, and it never makes any sense why they were included and why they were given a certain name. But Cole, I was like, they have to have plans for him. And it does seem at the end that we may be setting up a version of that character that's more in line with the version that we see in Ewan Marco's run.
It definitely feels like it. I don't have a lot of insider knowledge of that stuff, but by the end of season 2, it's like, okay, I can kind of see where they're going with it. But it is funny, because, like, I might be the only creator in history where I was just like, after watching season 1, I was like, they could have named him literally anything else, not paid me any money, and been totally fine, and fans online wouldn't have, like, flipped out on them. Because, like, there was a bit of that, too, because people were just like, what? Why would you do this to this character? Which is, you know, it's obviously their prerogative. I just didn't understand why they bothered calling him Cole North. Though I really love that they did, because, again, super cool
yeah.
for me and Marco.
And he has a very satisfying moment at the end of season two.
This is true. This is true.
But it was super
funny to me. I'm like, you know, God bless him. Like, I am genuinely excited that he's in the show, and I love the actor and I've become friends with him. And it's so cool for me and Marco, but also I'm just like, could have just named him something else. Saved yourself the trouble.
I think I remember Bendis saying after Homecoming came out that he was so confused why they brought basically the exact Genki character but named him Ned. Maybe they just didn't have faith in audiences to be able to pronounce Genki, but
it could be. It's also like what nerds are working on these movies. We're just like, let's call them this, let's call them that. Like, that, you know, either creates a financial headache for them or doesn't. It's a funny thing.
But I brought up season two because we were talking about kind of the final Luke Cage moment. And just with as much as your run has been referenced, I think that there were a lot of questions about whether we're potentially getting some kind of Mayor Cage situation there.
That'd be cool.
Certainly seems poised to return. So I think it's good timing to have him back at the center of the Marvel Universe again.
Yeah. 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 I mean, look, I would love it if there was a Mayor Cage. That'd be a nice feather in my cap. Maybe some more money for old Chipster.
There you go.
But yeah, it's funny, like, because we didn't do enough with that in the comics. And if they actually did more with that in the MCU, that'd be pretty funny. And then we had to, like, reflect that in the comics.
Yeah. Yeah. Again. Well, I'm very excited to see how Armageddon plays out and Avengers, but that is all I have for you today.
All right, man.
Thank you for coming back on. And, you know, next year when you're writing three more Marvel books, then you know, we'll have to do it again.
All right. Sounds like a deal.
All right. All right. Thanks, Chip.
All right. Thanks, man.